699G3, Ricky Lee Holmes, appellant, State Nevada respondent. Ms. Dickerson, if you are arguing, if you're ready to proceed.
Your Honor, can I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes.
May it please the Court, my name is Sharon Dickinson and I represent Ricky Holmes. We presented 7 issues to the Court, all of which we believe are meritorious. However, I wanted to begin by focusing on the first issue. Issue one involves a question about hearsay and impeachment and multiple different decisions by the Court over a two-day period. And all the Court's decisions basically violated Ricky Holmes' right to due process and right to present a defense. He didn't have a chance. This all began with the testimony of George Hickson. The State introduced an out-of-court statement from his wife, Toni. Now, George was in the bathroom at the time that there was a doorbell that rang, and they were surprised at 7 p.m. at night. He was in the bathroom, he said to his wife, Toni, go check to see who's there, what's going on. She came back, and she had a conversation with him. The State did not have Toni testify, but they had George testify, and the prosecutor asked, and what did she tell you? And George answers, she said there's somebody out there, and she sent them away. She didn't know them. Now, this was introduced by the State, the prosecutor, during their case in chief, and they didn't try to limit it, so it was taken as substantive evidence. Well, when the defense came up and decided to cross-examine George about this statement, they asked, did you have a chance to speak with her later about the conversation? And he said, yes. And the defense attorney said, and did she tell you the person there ringing the bell said they were there because they were being chased? At this time, the State began to object, but eventually George said she was rattling on and said something about being chased. I have no idea who was at the door. Now, these statements introduced by the prosecutor and then the defense became the subject of continuous objection by the prosecutor, saying that the defense has now opened up the door to allow us to impeach Mr. Holmes, even though he's not going to testify. So we get to bring in his prior felony convictions. Of course, defense objects and says that's not so, because this was not hearsay. Now, initially, the court agreed and said that the statements that she said, she was rattled and said somebody said something about being chased, were admissible under state of mind exception. But the following day, the court began to change its mind. And it said, well, if you ask any questions about Ricky's statements to the police about being chased, well, then we have a problem. We're going to allow in his prior convictions, even if he doesn't testify. And then the conversation went to the direction of, well, what are we going to say in closing argument about the statements that are already introduced? And defense attorneys said, I'm going to argue there's an inference that Ricky was at the front door and that he was being chased. And I want to ask the officers what he said, because the court told defense, you need to pick your poison here. I'm making these different rulings. You need to decide what you want to do. Well, ultimately, even though the defense asked the police about Ricky being chased, court would refuse to allow them to respond. Based on the fact that the defense attorney said, when we do closing, I'm going to argue an inference, which I believe I have a right to do, the court then allowed the prosecutor to introduce Ricky's prior convictions. It was 2005, both of them. One was assault with a deadly weapon and attempt robbery. And in closing, the prosecutors used this information to argue he had a motive to lie, because they knew they had these statements that were already introduced where somebody said they were being chased. This case asks this court to look at how NRS 51.069 and the impeachment statute interact. Because NRS 51.069 says when a hearsay statement has been admitted in evidence, the credibility of the declarant may be attacked or supported by any evidence which would be admissible for those purposes if the declarant had testified as a witness. The state contends that they're allowed to impeach him with his prior felonies. However, before prior felonies can be introduced, under the Whistler case and Byford, there's a test the court would have to go through. And this test begins with determine who introduced the statement. The statement was initially introduced by the state as substantive evidence, and the defense merely cross-examined. And I'm talking about the statement with Tony. You know, in this issue, we also argue we had a right to bring in the statement through the police because it was not hearsay. It's excited utterance, present sense impression, state of mind. But sticking on just Tony, the state's the one who introduced it, so they're not allowed to go ahead and try to impeach Ricky, who did not testify. The statement was introduced as not hearsay. And even if...
It's not clear to me that the defense didn't introduce it. I understand that the state opened it by saying, and what did she tell you? She said there's somebody out there and she sent them away. She didn't know them.
Correct.
But it was the defense that went into a direct leading question, which is appropriate. And did she tell you that the person there ringing the bell said they were there because they were being chased? That was elicited by the defense.
That's correct.
And as I understand the Byford intersection, that would take Byford out of the picture here and put it back into 51069 because the defense elicited that, not the state. So tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, the reason why I don't think it takes us out of Byford is because it's cross-examination and they're going into the statement that the state has already brought in. So I think under cross-examination you're allowed to...
Wasn't that statement limited that was brought in, and this seemed to amplify and open it up?
Exactly. He's more articulate than I on this.
The statement did go further. The question did go further into what she said. The state did just bring out the fact that they had the conversation that there was somebody at the door. So they brought, or at the gate with the bell. If the court believes that the defense brought in the statement further, and so Byford would split the baby. So
well, you're splitting. The first one was the hearsay statement of the wife.
Right.
Your cross-examination puts in the hearsay statement of
the wife,
the declarant to the wife, so it's double hearsay at that point because you're eliciting that the person on the phone told them they were being chased. So you have a double layer of hearsay. But as to the second layer, that came from the defense, not the state.
Your Honor, they were both double hearsay. George testified what his wife said, and then George testified what his wife said again.
Well, when George said, his wife said, there's somebody out there, I don't know who they are, and
right.
I told him to go on, that's single hearsay.
Oh, okay, you're right. And then the second statement was George said what his wife said again.
Well, George said what his wife said, the declarant said, and that was elicited purely by the defense.
That's correct. That was. But nonetheless, under the second step, it's not hearsay. It was an exception under the hearsay. It was an excited utterance. And secondly, there was no testimony that what the person said outside the gate was Ricky. Nobody testified it was Ricky. And that's all the defense wanted to do, is argue an inference that it was Ricky who made the statement to Tony, and also statements that were the same to the police officers. And so the argument that we had was that it falls under the exception to the hearsay rules. And once it falls under an exception, that prohibits the state from introducing the prior convictions. But even if it did not fall under an exception, the court still has to do a balancing test and decide whether or not it's more prejudicial than probative. And the court, in this case, under step four, never did step four, which decide whether or not this impeachment evidence should be introduced to it. We know that the statements were at an excited time. The declarant was excited. There was questions about being rattled. He later made similar statements to the police that he was being chased, which were not allowed to be introduced. Therefore, I'd argue that he was denied his right to fair trial by being impeached without testifying and no direct evidence saying, in fact, that he made any of these statements.
You're at 444. Do you wish to raise another point, or do you wish to keep the remainder of your time?
I was going to keep the remainder of my time unless somebody had a question about any of the other issues, so then I'll reserve my time. Thank you.
Ms. Overly?
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Sarah Overly, and I represent the respondent, the state of Nevada. To address appellant's first issue in regards to who elicited the statement, Your Honor is correct in that there was technically a double hearsay statement that was the subject of the issue here. First, it's the statement from Tony to George Hickson, her husband. Then there's the statement from the declarant at the gate to Tony, who subsequently stated that to George Hickson. When the state called George Hickson to testify, the state asked Mr. Hickson specifically whether his wife came back inside and indicated that she said there's somebody out there, she sent him away, she didn't know him. The state's subsequent question to Mr. Hickson was, based off her telling you that, what did you do? Mr. Hickson responded, well, I got up and went out. I was in the bathroom, and when I looked north, south, east, and west down the road and walked around a little bit, there's nobody visible I could see. So it's the state's position that when even the statement from Tony to George about what she did was elicited, it was done for purposes of determining what George did next, which was to go outside and determine if there was anyone out there. The state never elicited any statements from the declarant to Tony at the gate. However, on cross-examination, the defense specifically asked about her conversation with the declarant and specifically asked if that declarant indicated that they were being chased. So the state's position would be that this case is not analogous to Byford in that the state did not elicit this testimony. The state did not admit the statement from the appellant. It was, in fact, the appellant that elicited such statement. Furthermore, with regards to the issue of hearsay, there was ongoing discussions about that and whether or not each statement satisfied a hearsay exception. However, with regards to the statement by Tony or the statement from the declarant to Tony, there was never any indication that either met the excited utterance exception or that any met the state of mind exception. In fact, George testified that when Tony came back inside, he asked her what was going on. She never came back inside, asked him to call the police, lock the door, seemed distraught. And Tony never testified that the declarant was rattled. Instead, she indicated that he was rattling on about something. Additionally, there's nothing in 51069 that precludes the application of that statute to statements that do not apply to hearsay exceptions. In this case, it's the state's assertion that the district court judge, Judge Villani, got it right when he indicated that the appellant was essentially arguing out of both sides. In one respect, they were arguing that the statement was hearsay, that the appellant itself could not be attributed to that statement, so it should come in. Then, also, wanted to argue at closing that this statement was, in fact, from the appellant. Such that They wanted to circumvent the opportunity for the state to cross-examine that individual, the appellant, at trial. Therefore, the court held that they could, in fact, bring in the impeachment evidence, which were his prior convictions. Therefore, the state's position is that this case is similar to that of Gibbs, where the appellant strategically introduced his own hearsay statement to circumvent testifying. That is exactly what happened in this case. On cross-examination, the declarant statement from the gate was elicited by the defense. As a result, the defense sought to argue, and they're using the word infer to, again, circumvent that it came, in fact, from the defendant, but to argue nonetheless that at the time of closing, the declarant was, in fact, the defendant being chased. Furthermore, the statement to police officers, Officer Nito, that statement was independent of the 51069 analysis. That statement was precluded from coming in by the district court because it was ruled as not being an exception to the hearsay rule. There was ongoing argument about whether or not that satisfied a state of mind exception of the defendant at the time. And the court found that it was not, and found that it was a subsequent statement made to police officers and lacked the trustworthiness associated with that exception because he had the opportunity to generate a story and come up with an argument that he had been chased. And to further support the arguments that the defendant was in fact trying to circumvent testifying, the court even acknowledged this at one point and said, see, that's the problem. I mean, it could be considered a state of mind, but then you're also saying on the one hand it wasn't him. If it was him, then we get into impeaching under 51069, Byford and Gibbs. Therefore, it is the state's position that this was a strategic move on the defense's part. In fact, defense even stated, and Your Honor, I don't know when you plan on admonishing him, but part of the reasons why we made some of the decisions we made with this case is because Mr. Holmes has elected to serve his right to remain silent and he will not be testifying. So is the state's assertion that at one point the appellant argued that it was hearsay such that it could come in, but then when being confronted with the argument that they'd be precluded from being able to argue that it was the defendant who made that statement, then tried to argue that, well, we're just arguing an inference, not so much that it is in fact him.
Is this an area that is the subject of confusion in district courts, 51069? I mean, it's coming up in Gibbs, it's coming up here again.
Frankly, Your Honor, it's my understanding that it's not an issue that is brought up quite frequently. Thanks. In fact, Judge Villani brought it up because I believe he presided over Gibbs, so he was familiar with the case decision.
So this is not some raging uncertainty about how you read 51069?
I don't believe so. I believe this might be one of the first opportunities that Judge Villani had, you know, with regards to the factual scenario here. But he was familiar with Gibbs and Byford. In fact, he's the one that initiated the conversation with regards to those court decisions.
Okay, thank you. I didn't mean to throw you off.
No, that's fine. So
I know I think we might have some students out here in the audience or today watching, law students or whatever. So the issue with Mr. Holmes, as far as I'm going to testify, if he did testify, then his past criminal felony record would become an issue, and you could ask him what he was previously convicted of as far as felonies, where if he doesn't testify, he doesn't come in. Is that the key issue here?
Precisely, Your Honor. And that's exactly what 51069 provided for, was that the state could essentially impeach the declarant as though they had testified. So any impeachable evidence was going to be admissible. And that's why two of the defendant's prior convictions from 2005 were actually not admitted in terms of their judgments themselves, but they were stipulated to on the record.
Okay.
Could you turn to the issue of the challenge for cause of juror, I think it was 232.
Yes, Your Honor.
And my question on juror 232, again, was that juror an ethnic minority, or Do you have a recollection? Does the record reflect that?
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent question, Your Honor. I don't believe they were.
So there wasn't a Batson issue tied to 232?
There was no Batson issue. It was merely an issue of whether or not his answers to specific questions were going to allow him to follow jury instructions.
And I think what he was saying is that eyewitness testimony may not be sufficient in his mind to create enough evidence for the state to meet its burden of proof.
Correct. In fact, I specifically asked Juror 232, this is from the transcript, okay, and what if there was a situation where the only thing was eyewitness testimony? Now, granted, you believe that eyewitness testimony, but that was all that was there. Juror 232 answered, I would have, in my opinion, a reasonable doubt in that case. I asked, so if there was, for example, only one witness to a crime and you believed that person, but there was nothing else like DNA or fingerprints or anything like that, that automatically for you would be reasonable doubt? He responded, it would. I would not believe necessarily that every eyewitness is reliable. I said, okay, but even if you believe that one eyewitness, you would still need something else? His answer was, yes, there's no special reason why I would that I can convince of at this conceive of at this moment of why I would believe a single eyewitness.
But didn't the state the defense basically rehabilitate Juror 232? I mean, I think it was a close call on a for cause.
And Judge Villani made mention of that. He indicated that there was an opportunity to rehabilitate that juror, but he did not feel as though it was done sufficiently. And he believed that, you know, within his discretion, he wanted to grant the state's motion for a challenge for cause.
And again, is the point of that being that the jury can consider all legally relevant evidence, including eyewitness is just one component of it. There could be other types of evidence as well.
Exactly. A number of different types of evidence. Okay. And it was the state's position that with regards to challenges for cause, the district court does have broad discretion in granting those. And considering that it was, as Your Honor stated, somewhat of a close call, that Judge Villani was correct in being able to grant the state's motion at that moment. Did Your Honors have any other questions?
On the sentencing. Now, after yes. Mr. Holmes was convicted, Judge Villani exercised his discretion to sentence him as a habitual criminal, meaning he had prior criminal offenses, and it increases the sentence maybe significantly. Why was that not an abuse of discretion to sentence him as a habitual criminal, in your view?
Well, Your Honor, under the Nevada statutes, we are permitted to adjudicate someone as a habitual offender, be it a small habitual offender or a large habitual offender, based off of the number of felony convictions that they have. It is the state's burden to provide proof of those judgments of convictions at the time of sentencing. In this case, the state introduced specifically, I believe it was 5 different felony convictions associated with the appellant's history. Specifically a 1991 burglary, a 2001 burglary, a 2001 attempt burglary, and then the two 2005 convictions that were referenced during the trial. All of those were provided to the court by means of a judgment of conviction or an amended judgment of conviction. And there was also some statement in the appellant's brief referencing that some of those amended judgments of conviction were insufficient in that they failed to reference a specific attorney being present at the time that those convictions were imposed.
Is there any reason we should be concerned about the delay in providing those documents to the court?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because it was not done for purposes of delay and it was not done in any bad faith. The sentencing transcript even indicated that those judgments of convictions had been ordered. The deputy in court that day was not aware of why they were not in the file and would follow up on them immediately.
But it's the state's obligation to provide them since they wanted to go with the enhancement of sentencing, and their delay, so to speak, did cause prejudice to the defendant since he was found an habitual criminal based upon those documents.
That is correct, Your Honor, and that it was delayed. It was delayed 25 days to be exact. And it gave the state the opportunity to obtain those judgments of conviction. But I would argue, too, that every single judgment of conviction that was admitted at sentencing were Nevada judgments of conviction, meaning that they weren't judgments that needed to be obtained out of state for long
that
delay.
That kind of goes against the grain of what you're arguing, because if they were Nevada documents, then there's no real reason for the delay. If they were out of state, it's understandable that it might take a little more to get them in a timely fashion, but there is concern if they're local documents.
And that's correct, Your Honor. And I believe the state's position on that would be that there are often times that the state could take as much as a 15-minute break and go and print out those judgments and get them certified in our same building. And that was certainly an option, but that just further supports that it wasn't done for the purposes of delay and that it could have been done at that opportunity. But the district court determined that the case should be continued for sentencing, not only for that purpose, but also to have Judge Villani preside over the sentencing.
Just as a sentencing, again, maybe for some of the people present, the maximum sentence, as I recall, for burglary, and burglary is generally when you enter a building with the intention to commit a crime within the building, whether it's murder or stealing or whatever, or a car as well as a building. The maximum sentence for burglary is minimum 4 years in prison, maximum 10 years. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And so, meaning you have to do at least 4 years, but you're eligible for parole after four, and you definitely get out after 10. You know, that's the back end of it. Now, as far as the sentence, I see it was 60 months, which is 5 years, to 150 months, which is 15 years. So his sentence was enhanced. The minimum part was enhanced an extra year, and the back end was an extra 5 years as a result of the habitual criminal.
Correct. And just to note as well, he was also convicted of possession of burglary tools, which carries with it a 364-day sentence.
So that's a gross misdemeanor?
That is a gross misdemeanor.
Okay, and a gross misdemeanor, the maximum sentence is, what, 1 year?
1 year.
And for a regular misdemeanor, it's 6 months, then, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
And did Your Honors have any other questions with regards to the sentencing?
No additional questions.
Okay. So if Your Honors don't have any other questions, the state believes that any of the appellant's alleged errors in this case were not in fact errors, but if the court were to find that they in fact were, they were harmless and did not prejudice the defendant in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Dickinson?
Going back to the first issue, there are four steps that the court had to go through. So even if the court determines that defense introduced a statement, under the second step, identifying who the non-testifying declarant was never identified. No one ever identified Ricky as being that person. Nobody, and in closing, the defense only argued there's an inference that it was him. So even if the state gets past step one, they don't get past step two, because no one knows who the declarant was. And that's important because the state chose not to bring in Tony. They chose to bring in evidence through charge.
Does the court just disregard the question that was asked by defense on cross?
Well, of course you can't disregard it, but I think that the defense had an obligation to cross-examine George about what the state brought out, that he had a conversation with Tony. It's in the record.
The question seemed an open-ended. They didn't identify who the conversation was, as you posed.
Right.
So what was the point of the question then?
Well, the point of the question was to determine what was said, because they already said that she had a conversation with somebody at the front door. But there was no identification as to who it was. But if the court disagrees and thinks that it did identify Ricky, we go to step three, and it's not hearsay. It was an excited utterance. It was state of mind.
Why was it an excited utterance? What information was produced that makes it that? That's the state's position. So,
The words that George used in relaying the conversation said the person was rattled. And because the person was rattled,
she made a distinction that she said he rattled on. That was, those are the words the state used.
Right. He rattled on. When someone rattles on, I interpret that to mean they are rattled. And so...
Well, someone these days, and I hate to say this, that has gray hair like I do, they say they rattle on. Because of age. Not being rattled, but rattle on. So it's a matter of inference, what you're talking about.
It was at a time... That statement was made. It was a time when he rang the doorbell, or somebody rang the doorbell, and was asking information. And then subsequent to this, it's not too long after this, we have the car alarm going off after George.
Well, the question is whether it would be a correct interpretation that it was rattled on opposed to rattled.
It does say rattled on, and I interpret that to mean the person is rattled. And that's the reason they're speaking that way.
Fair enough, but didn't you also, not you personally, but the defense, confirm that they intended to use the statement they elicited when the state objects and you have the colloquy with the court, that they wanted to say the person speaking to Tony was your client and that he was afraid he was being chased?
I believe that conversation came out the second day of the arguments about it, where the defense said, I just want to make clear that to the court that I'm going to argue there's an inference here in closing.
Right. So you, I kind of see Judge Villani's point. I mean, you're saying defense wants to attribute the person who spoke to the woman, they want to say that that was the defendant. If they want to say that was the defendant, and I know you disagree with it, but hold with just the point of the identity of the defendant, and use that statement to argue that he was being chased and that excuses what he did and made it not burglary, then why wouldn't that come in? You're now arguing, well, it isn't clear who the declarant was, but did you make that argument to the district court?
I do believe they did.
Continue.
But even if the court disagrees, we're now down to step four, which the district court still had to go through, and that is, was the introduction of the prior convictions more prejudicial than probative? And here we have a few words that were introduced, no identity.
And but you had committed that you were going to say that was the defendant speaking to Tony.
They argued in closing that there's an inference that it could be Ricky speaking to Tony about being chased. In return, the court introduced two prior felony convictions, none of which have anything to do with this particular type of crime, and so they were more prejudicial than probative.
Yeah, no, I understand that point. I was just trying to understand the identity point and where in the record the defense said, well, this isn't Ricky. We don't know who it was.
My understanding of the record is very convoluted, was that nobody ever specifically said it was Ricky except for the state. The state argued in closing that Ricky had a motive to lie and said that he was being chased. I don't have the exact words, but it was the state who argued it was Ricky and he had a motive to lie.
We understand the point that you're raising this. This matter will stand submitted at this time. The court thanks both Ms. Dickerson and Ms. Overly for their arguments today, and from an academic standpoint, a journey back into hearsay, double and triple hearsay, and what it may or may not be used for. With that, we stand adjourned till 1:30. Matter submitted.